I think comedy should be whatever's funny to the performer. The audience can decide whether they want to laugh or not. I don't think any performer should be changing what they do and don't say. But I'll always be a supporter of a comedian saying whatever the hell they do, whatever want to come out their mouth, say that shit.
I'm Justin Jay. As a photographer, I've gotten to shoot rock stars, hip-hop moguls, world-class athletes, and some other truly extraordinary subjects. I'm fascinated by the backstories and life experiences that help shape these compelling people. The right photograph can reveal quite a lot about someone, but some stories can't be told with just a picture. Sometimes you need to sit down, listen, and dig a little deeper. This is The Plug.
At its core, stand-up comedy is about making people laugh. But certain comics are willing to go beyond the punchline and explore areas that are dangerous, complex, and controversial. It can be a risky endeavor and the stakes are high. But when it's executed in a thought-provoking way with empathy, compassion, and heart, it has the unique potential to transcend cultural divisions and political chasms. Today's guest is a multi-talented comedian who's not afraid to tackle sensitive issues related to race or social class. He's appeared on The Daily Show, hosted the prestigious White House Correspondents' Dinner, and has garnered critical acclaim for his numerous stand-up specials. His latest special, Imperfect Messenger, fearlessly delves into topics such as Confederate pride, slavery, and criminal justice reform. He skillfully blends humor, personal anecdotes, and perspective in a way that resonates with a wide audience and sparks meaningful dialogue. It's a masterclass on how comedy can be a tool not just to entertain, but to unify and inspire conversation. So why does he think the character Jack Bauer from the TV show 24 perfectly encapsulates what it's like to be in the entertainment business? We'll find out as we sit down for a chat with the man behind Comedy Central's all-time highest-rated original stand-up premiere. Today, writer, actor, comedian and brilliant social critic, Mr. Roy Wood Jr.
Oh, yeah, I'm good to go, brother.
Okay. Roy Wood Jr., thank you so much for taking the time to sit down, man. It's great to see you.
Man, good to see you. How you been?
I'm good. You've had quite a year. You guest hosted The Daily Show. You hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You got a big tour coming up.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of been plugging away at the stand-up game for quite some time, but, I mean, do you get the sense that does this year feel a little different for you? Like, are you optimistic about what's going to happen?
I mean, this is going to sound very cliched and canned, but honestly, stand-up is high tide, low tide. You just have to keep doing well. So you have a couple of good hits. It's like baseball. There's streaks and there's slumps. You know, I'm in a little bit of a streak right now, but, you know, I've been in slumps before and I know what that's like. So the only difference is that in real life, a slump means you may or may not be able to pay your bills. So I try my best to make sure that whatever I'm doing is from a space of building my brand because, you know, a writer's strike hit, you know, people be talking about hosting The Daily Show, there might not be no TV no more at the end of this strike. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. So I'm proud of what I've done, but it does not, I'm not going to rest on that. I still need to go out and be funny. I'm going on tour this summer, so the jokes need to be sharp. So it's back to the clubs. That was nice, kicking it
it's
at
about
a bunch
the next
of,
one, yeah, not the previous one. Yeah.
It's literally the next mission. The season 3 ending of 24 is so fucking perfect to explain what stand-up comedy is. And Kiefer Sutherland's character, Jack Bauer, he's just saved the world. He's just done the most amazing, miraculous thing that you could ever, like, no one else could have done it. How did you beat the odds? How did you do it? And he goes and sits in his car and he cries from the stress of the day. And while he's crying, somebody walkie-talkies him. Hey, Jack, we need you for the next whatever the hell is going on. And he just fucking wipes the tears. This is Jack Bauer. I'm on the way. And that's how the season three ends of 24. And that's literally what entertainment is.
Wow. Well, I want to ask you about the correspondence dinner for a second. It must have been a really unique audience because, I mean, A, you got President Biden right there in front of you. And then some of the other people that you want to kind of roast or do topical humor about, they're also in the room. But it's also famously the same room where a few years ago, Seth Meyers eviscerated Donald Trump right to his face, you know, and being the petty, vindictive man that he is, rumor has it, that's what kind of set the spark for him to want to become president and make a run for it. Did you feel the history and the gravity of that when you stepped to the mic of like this fucking crazy chapter that started right there in that room?
No, I didn't feel any of that. To me, it was just do your jokes, do your job. The idea that my performance could trigger apocalyptic policies is a lot of weight to put on a single joke. I do not believe that any one joke can change everything. It might be able to change the minds of people who can then go out and be active and change things. But I wasn't thinking, I better not talk about Ron DeSantis because then he gonna really be president. No, the joke is the joke. We have to address what's going on in the country. And so that's what I did. But I didn't really think about it like that.
I mean, I think in an ideal world, you would be able to use comedy as a device for people to change their mind. And, you know, you present the joke, you put it in a unique way, and it's humorous and it's thoughtful and it's cogent. And ideally, in theory, the audience would take that in and accept the logic and maybe be open to changing their mind. But, you know, as the great Neil Brennan once said, that's like bringing facts to a feelings fight, you know? And so, I mean, do you get the sense that you've ever actually been able to move the needle with some of your comedy, or do you ever get cynical that you're just kind of preaching to the choir, albeit in a very funny way?
I think the job of a comedian is to broadcast what's happening. What happens on the other side of that is out of our control. I think anybody who thinks that their words are these omnipotent things that will change everything, you know, look at how hard Jon Stewart has had to fight for something as simple and bipartisan as the Zadroga Act. Just, hey, if you're a firefighter and you're down at ground zero, you deserve health care until you die. Just a basic thing.
You think
how
it would be irrefutable.
Jon Stewart, to the point where Jon Stewart has lost. He's not even trying to be funny about the Zadroga shit anymore, is what I'm trying to say. He's abandoned humor as an effective tool, and now he's like straight, I'm going to hit you with the shame sledgehammer and try and get you to act right. So I don't think about my material in the sense of, did this rock make a dent in the thing? It's just my job to present the stuff and what happens on the other side of it. Because when you start getting into cause and effect of your jokes, then for me, I feel like I get more detached from just trying to be funny, which is what I set out to be, and that was the original goal. So, you know, it's nice when you get an email from someone that's on the right side of an issue going, thank you, we're down here doing this stuff, appreciate you for amplifying. You know, that helps me keep going. You know, The Daily Show, I enjoy being more of a conduit for people who don't have access to a camera and a microphone. Like, that's, to me, more rewarding than telling a joke in the studio. I'd much rather be out in the field following somebody that's actually doing the work.
Well, I want to ask you about The Daily Show for a second, because it seems like it would be very easy to make comedy about Trump and the MAGA Republicans, because the hypocrisy is just so flagrant and obvious. But it seems also that sometimes the progressives have a really difficult time being forced to take an honest and critical view about some things that maybe aren't in order in their house as well. You know, and in these kind of tribal times that we live in, it's easy to fall into this mindset that any comedy that's critical of the Democrats or any comedy that's critical of Biden is somehow disloyal, or that you're helping the other side. You know, I mean, to take a look at, like, Bill Maher, for instance, I don't think his disdain for Trump and for the Republicans is any secret, but he's cut a lot of shit from the left by calling out some things that he thinks are not really in order with some of the progressives. And, you know, with that in mind, I'm wondering about, with The Daily Show, a lot of people tune into that show for expecting a very particular political viewpoint. And I'm wondering, have you noticed any internal conflicts while you work in there for pieces that were pitched that were very critical of the left?
No, you don't get controversy for pitching things that are critical of the left. I think the issue within our show is that you have to have nuance in why you're doing anything. Like, if you look at what Jordan Klepper does with Fingering the Pulse, and he goes out and he talks to constituents. That's essentially a constituent-based segment. It's more conversational, and you're giving people an opportunity to present how and why they view something. Whereas if you look at a studio segment, there has to be a little bit more nuance. If you're just going to go, like, if we're going to use Bill Maher as an example, Bill Maher had a segment on his show not too long ago about Dianne Feinstein. This is back when she had yet to return to chambers to start voting again. He, as a singular person, is able to attack that from the viewpoint that he best sees fit. Whereas a correspondent, you are also, in a way, honoring the viewpoint of the host. And so, you know, it's a little weird and different for us now because we have a bunch of guest hosts. So the show has a North Star, but there's also the opinions of the guests. And sometimes a lot of the stuff that people want to criticize the left about, it might be something that the guests really don't want to get into. You know, for me, with my guest hosting week, I'm just more of an issue-driven person than I am attacking people. I just don't feel like... I feel like people change, the issues stay the same. So, you know, for, you know, you get this one deep dive segment called Long Story Short, and you can go into whatever you want to talk about people. But for me, I just wanted to talk about colleges. Yeah. I just wanted to talk about the price of education in that institution. I think corporations are a far larger detriment to this country than politicians. Most of the politics in this country are byproducts of the ideology of corporations that fund the politicians who make the policies. So, you know, I don't know. Like, even with the correspondents' dinner, I knew that there would be certain jokes that the left wouldn't be feeling. But I can't go up there and not acknowledge Joe Biden and documents and not make a joke about that. I can't ignore his age and that being a topic of conversation with regards to reelection. Now, how do I make that funny? That's a separate issue. But I think what a lot of people are talking about is figuring out, how do you not turn this into a joke that people use as ammunition to either, it's confirmation bias. So I'm going to take anything you joke about. And if I want to be offended, I'm going to be offended. I'm going to say you were ageist. I'm going to say you were mean. I did a school shooting joke, and it was strictly a school shooting joke. But somehow that joke has come out as me being pro-trans. And it's like, well, if that's what you took from the setup, then you missed the joke. Like that, like you're assigning all of this extra shit to jokes. And it's like sometimes it's just a joke.
And there's certain topics, whether it's like, you know, Trump and DeSantis, the person and the topic are the same thing. They're so intertwined. You can't really joke about the policies without the person because they've purposefully made them intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things where you have no choice but to kind of dabble in both. You know, you don't have a choice these days.
Was it a very different experience guest hosting as opposed to being a correspondent?
It was easier, like in the sense that, and I'm not saying that hosting's some easy thing to do. It's very difficult, but in terms of the comedic ideology, as a correspondent, you get to just do jokes, which in theory is easy. But if you want to add feeling or emotions or opinions, you're generally not given that runway because there's no time. But as a host, you get to add all of these other intangible prisms to how you feel about something and not just solely make it funny. And I enjoyed that because, you know, that's what I try to do with my stand-up. I try to make some of it funny, but also at the core, I'm trying to make people feel good.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Do you feel that it's more difficult or that there's more potential for blowback as a Black comedian doing content that maybe is critical of the Black community or as a progressive that's doing content that's critical of the left?
What's more dangerous or what leaves you more open to criticism? I think black on black. I think if you are critical of the left, but still somehow showing support of the left, then you probably still have some degree of an in, or there will still be people that will give you audience or whatever. Whereas if you're being critical of black people, you got to be very careful about that, bro, because people are going to take that and weaponize that, who have far more sinister intentions to black people. So that's something you got to be very careful about that.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't know what people are going to use. And, you know, that's why, like, you know, in black circles, you know, there's a saying where, you know, some stuff is just family business. Certain things you just don't bring out into the mainstream and have a discussion about, because within our community, I think that there are other people that use those conversations to help justify, you know, policy.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I rewatched Imperfect Messenger recently, and I have to say, I think that's one of the most compassionate and honest and just generally like funniest stand-up specials that I've seen in a very long time. Like, bravo. It's a fantastic stand-up special.
Thank you.
And I would place it in, you know, the same category and the same classes, like, as a Chris Rock or a Dave Chappelle or a Richard Pryor, in terms of presenting a black perspective in a very thought-provoking way, you know. But at the same time, I know on that same topic, both Chappelle and Chris Rock have been really vocal about some of the bits that they've done over the course of their career, that they're very uncomfortable with the way that they've been embraced by certain white audiences, whether that's because they're laughing maybe for the wrong reason, or because, like you said, they've weaponized that critique and used it to justify or reinforce like existing prejudices that they've already had. I mean, is that something that you think about when you're writing your material?
I think about how can this be misunderstood. That's how I think of most jokes now. And you're not going to be bulletproof on that, but you just have to figure out a way. But it also, part of that process is, to me, part of that process is about making sure that you're running these jokes and these perspectives in front of black audiences. You're going to be talking about a group of people, or you're going to be bringing an issue to a group of people, then you need to be talking about that in front of those people. Because that the reaction, the visceral reaction from audiences, is going to help shape the bit to make it right for television, so you can be more precise. So you got to step on landmines a couple of times to get to the right place. You know, there's a bit. It's not even, I won't even do the joke, but within Imperfect Messenger, the part where I talk about prison reform and this idea that we want nonviolent drug offenders to get out early and, oh, it's just weed, you should be free. Okay, cool. But there's also violent offenders who got too much time. And that's not part of the conversation, but to me, it should be. And that's not to belittle, oh, you got caught with an ounce of weed and you're still in jail and weed is legal. Okay, yeah, let him out. But also that guy that did 20 years for a stabbing, who probably should have gotten 5, he should get out too. But that guy did a lot of damage in the black community, so screw him. You know, like that dynamic in that conversation, you know, that it's, and ultimately that bit was going a different way. And then I kind of got into a back and forth with an audience member because, you know, for your listeners who don't know, you know, I have a friend that was at a robbery that turned into a murder. He was not inside. He got charged with murder. I don't agree with that law. I don't think that law is right. You're just not going to get. But what I learned over the course of presenting that material to audiences, who some of those people have lost family members to domestic issues, to guns and knife violence, right? I discovered, oh, it's not even my place to have an opinion on this. This is a conversation that should be had strictly with victims and lawmakers. Me, the outsider who's never lost someone, shouldn't even be talking about it. And that discovery through the joke bombing a couple of times, I discovered that was the joke and that was the landing point to end on. And that's what I put on television. So you have to be able to step in it. The issue now is that the internet and camera phones have eliminated the incubation period needed for a joke to grow from the wrong place to the right place. We're not extended that anymore as performers.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that I appreciated most about Imperfect Messenger is that it just, it had this sense of compassion and discovery and learning. And it ended on kind of on a very emotional note without sounding preachy. It didn't end on a big laugh and a big callback, but I think that story, it's wonderful to hear the progression of how that bit came to be, because it was really, it was a really emotional moment of that special.
Yeah, and that was like really where I was trying to get to, is that, you know, even myself, I'm not perfect in the things that I'm, you know, crusading for and fighting for and trying to make right.
You know, for most people, if you were to ask them one of their biggest fears, I think the fear of public speaking would rank right up there for most people or a lot of people. For somebody who basically does that for a living, I'm wondering, do you have a particular moment in a set, especially when it's a really high stakes set, like maybe the White House Correspondents' Dinner, or you're taping a special, is there a particular moment where you really feel that you've got the audience or that your swagger kicks in? It kind of make almost liken it to that moment in The Wizard of Oz when everything turns from black and white to color. Like, is that an apt analogy?
You don't want to get too arrogant, but you definitely know when, okay, I know what I'm doing here and I'm confident in the rest of my material. For the Correspondents' Dinner, it was the Dominion voting joke, which was, I think, the third joke.
So when that landed, you kind of got the sense that the butterflies disappear and it turns a little bit more into like fun instead of torture?
Yeah, well, not fun, but just, okay, you know what you're doing, now execute. So we're not, the boat's not taking on water, now we can paddle. You know, you've gotten that first, it's like a quarterback, you get that first completion in the Super Bowl. And now you're just playing football again. Because the Joe Biden joke, the first joke where I hand him the classified documents, that wasn't a joke that I ran in the comedy clubs. You know, that was just one that I just kind of threw out there. You know, and it worked.
Did you tailor that set specifically to, I mean, obviously you can't just come right out and go in on Joe Biden. Like, did you have to kind of find some common ground? I mean, was there a lot of intention in terms of finding some jokes that you can kind of Trojan horse your way into some material that might be a little bit more divisive later on in the
well,
set?
Well, yeah, I had to, because they don't know me, so I can't come out there swinging like that, because they're not going to go, who the hell does this guy think he is coming in our house and disrespecting us? So the first joke is on Biden. He's the most powerful person in the room. The next two jokes, one is a fear-based joke. The second joke is a fear joke. The third joke is self-deprecation. So at that point, I still haven't gone at anyone in the room or anything that, no sacred cows at that point. And Biden thankfully did well, which helped make the document joke work, because it was already a jovial, jokey kind of, and he joked with me with the Dark Brandon thing. So in a weird way, there's rapport. There's not a standoffish power dynamic happening between me and the president. So then the second joke is complimenting the audience and saying, you got money from the Fox Dominion lawsuit. I'm scared of Dominion. I love Dominion. I don't want Dominion to sue me. Third joke is, I know you all think I'm Kenan Thompson. I'm not. So at that point, from a, like, if you think about this like psychology, I'm being gracious. And then we start getting into, I think George Santos was the next one. And then from Santos, we went Tucker Carlson, Don Lemon. And that's more community bashing. You know, hey, don't we all not like these people? Joke, joke, joke. Sneak in a little bit of stuff about CNN still being inconsistent and having it, like that, and then that's where we started to slowly get into Don Lemon, Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. Did you have a pivot in your back pocket if Biden didn't take that joke as graciously as he did?
No.
Would that have changed things?
No. No. The jokes are the jokes at that point. I could make a comment on him not liking the joke, you know. It's okay. I know nobody likes it when they find their documents, you know, leaving their documents around. You know, it's like, I tell you what, I'm gonna keep this one and sell it to Russia or, you know, whatever. But if that joke doesn't do well, then you just play it off like it was never intended to be a joke. Because the next thing out of my mouth was, hello, how are you doing? Yeah.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
I saw you perform at City Winery last year, and you told a really personal story about your experience appearing on the PBS show Finding Your Roots, and you found out some really kind of disturbing and personal information about your father in that show. And also I've noticed in Imperfect Messenger and a lot of your stand-up, there's a lot of real personal material in there. And I'm wondering, you know, where does that come from? Like, do you find it cathartic to stand and tell maybe painful or difficult stories in front of groups of strangers? Or is it more simple than that? Is it just that, you know, great writers write what they know?
Yeah, I think it's cathartic in a way. Like, I'm not necessarily trying to do like group therapy and turn the audience into my therapist. But, you know, this is what's interesting to me. And it's dark and it's complicated. And I think that's what's relatable.
Yeah. I mean, but I'm saying you could definitely choose to not do comedy that comes from a place of pain or personal exploration. But you do, you know, so I mean, you must get something out of that.
Yeah, you're right what you know. I mean, it's cool to talk about. It's just talking it through. To me, even ultimately with the material about my father, it's just using it as a springboard to make the point to the audience that old people should be passing down their fears and their traumas to their children, not just food recipes. Tell me what you're going through mentally. Because the chances are one of your descendants is going through it too. And they need some ideas on what the hell is going on in their head. So you might be able to help your family start at second base in their healing process on something.
I'm curious, was that something that you have used since then? Has that become part of your act? Or is that something that you were just really like working out because it was front and center in your mind and you just experienced
it? I was still working that out. I think you're talking about the Neil Brennan show, which was a show specifically where Neil and I agreed that we would only do new stuff and stuff that just really hadn't been fleshed out yet. That's a joke that I'm not even touring with right now this summer. Like, that's a bit that I really want to sit on for one of my hour specials. My next run of hour specials is going to be a trilogy about fatherhood. And that's definitely one of the stories that's going to be in there somewhere.
I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I really appreciated and enjoyed that particular set is because you really got a sense that you were seeing the process unfold. And it wasn't just set up, punchline. It was material that was fresh and new and really meant something to you. I mean, there was a lot of heart in that set. But, I mean, it was funny, obviously, but it was fascinating getting to see the process unfold.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, we always like to end this podcast by asking the guests to plug something that they're not personally involved in that they feel isn't getting enough shine, whether it's like a TV show, a movie, a book, a comic, a social cause. Is there something you want to shout out and give some attention to?
Bumpkiss on Peacock. Pete Davidson is a maniac. That shit is hilarious.
I haven't seen that yet. I'll check that out.
I'm not in it. I am not connected to it in any shape, form, or fashion. But Bumpkiss on Peacock. Pete Davidson is a maniac. That shit is hilarious.
I'll check that out.
I don't know, bro. It's like Entourage meets Atlanta on Staten Island. I don't even know how to compare. I don't even know what to compare it to, but it's pretty wild. So I'm sorry I don't have a social justice cause. I just been binging Bumpkiss. That's all I've been doing this week.
That's amazing. I mean, who are you fans of as a comic? Like who maybe not either from your class or someone from the past. Like who are you just straight up appreciate their work?
Samore has what I consider to be one of the best Netflix specials of this year so far. I'm sure Wanda Sykes is going to give some more run for her money. I haven't seen Wanda's yet. This is young brother Niles Apston that's making some noise. You know, he's more of a writer director as well. He's a Swiss Army knife, but I really think that he's got some solid material and he's got a good head on his shoulders. And the homegirl Paris Sachet, I like Paris too. She's funny.
And you know, when doing jokes that are topical in nature or that have like a kind of a social justice element, what are your thoughts on this notion of whether you can do jokes that punch up or punch down? I mean, do you make that distinction or should comedy just be about what's fair and what's funny?
I think comedy should be whatever's funny to the performer. The audience can decide whether they want to laugh or not. I don't think any performer should be changing what they do and don't say. You just have to know that there's certain people aren't going to rock with you. Certain companies may not work with you. Certain venues may not book you. But I'll always be a supporter of a comedian saying whatever the hell they do, whatever want to come out their mouth, say that shit. For me personally, I find more fun in going to unexpected places with punchlines that people wouldn't have predicted. So, you know, that's just how I choose to build my act.
All right. Well, Roy, I want to say thanks again for taking the time out to do this. We're going to keep this episode short and sweet because I know you've got a lot on your plate, but I want to do a quick plug once again. If you hadn't had a chance, go check out Imperfect Messenger. It's available on Paramount Plus, and go see Roy Wood Jr. in person in the next couple months. Roy, I really appreciate what you do. You're a very funny man, and I wish you all the best. Hopefully our paths will cross soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and a huge thanks to today's guest for dropping in. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and take a minute to rate, review, follow, or subscribe. This episode of The Plug was executive produced by Peter Buckingham with original theme music by Andrew Van Weingarten and Dan Drohan. Logo design and branding by Italic at www.italic-studio.com. Sound design by Brad Worrell at Soundwag. And you can check out my photography at justinj.com. Thanks again, and be sure to tune in for future conversations.
And don't forget to post your job for free at linkedin.com/surf. That's linkedin.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.